Welcome to Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host for this hour, Ursula Rudenberg, and I appreciate your listening in. It's good to be with you. Did wake up early in this morning to thunderstorms, and there is some chance of precipitation early in the rest of the week. Sunny today with a high near 92, possibly going above 100, but tonight rain and thunderstorms are likely again in the wee hours of the morning. Tuesday sees a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms after 1 p.m. and otherwise sunny in the 90s. Tuesday night will see a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms. From then on, though, for the rest of the week and the weekend, expect sunny days and clear nights with temperatures in the 80s, and nights should dip down to the 60s and 50s. Now, here is Mr. Dennis Hart with a summary of Iowa news.
The coronavirus continuing its comeback in Iowa. The amazing story of that teenager who was seriously injured in Adventureland on the July 4th weekend. And the passing of a Central Iowa TV legend. All made big news around the state last week. First, the coronavirus. The number of new reported cases of the virus in Iowa continued going up last week as the Delta variant spread throughout the state and the nation. Iowa was averaging more than 500 new cases a day, the first time the daily average has topped 500 new daily cases since mid-April. And 10 new deaths from the virus were reported last week, bringing to nearly 6,200 the number of people who have died from the coronavirus in Iowa. And the number of Iowans hospitalized with the virus went up to 214, 36% higher than the week before. The number of Iowans receiving their first dose of the coronavirus vaccine did edge back up after weeks of decline. About half the state's population has now received at least one dose of the vaccine. Polk County's health director had a warning last week for Iowans as the Delta variant of the virus surged throughout the state. Helen Eddy said, in her words, "If you remain unvaccinated, you will get COVID. The only question is how sick you will become." Eddy spoke after federal experts declared Polk County to be a high transmission area for the virus. The Centers for Disease Control recommends that people in high or substantial spread areas, including 90 of Iowa's 99 counties, resume wearing masks in public indoor spaces, even if they are vaccinated. The CDC also recommends that everyone in schools wear masks. Governor Reynolds has rejected the CDC recommendations, saying they were, in her words, not grounded in reality or common sense. And a spokesman for the governor said she was proud of the bill she had signed in late May that immediately overturned mask requirements in schools and prohibited mask requirements in cities and towns. And last week, the Iowa State Fair announced that masks will not be required at the fair and that capacity will not be limited inside any buildings. But Polk County did take action, announcing this past Friday that masks for all staff and visitors in county buildings would be required, effective today. And the city of Des Moines announced that the public would have to wear masks in city government buildings. That includes the Des Moines City Hall, public libraries, the Municipal Service Center, public works buildings, the fire and police departments, and more. Also last week, Tyson Foods announced it would require all of its 120,000 U.S. employees, including those in Iowa, to get vaccinated by November 1st. That makes Tyson the biggest food company to mandate vaccinations. Less than half of Tyson's workforce is now vaccinated. And Unity Point Health, one of Iowa's biggest hospital and clinic systems, said it would require employees to be vaccinated against the virus. And Des Moines' biggest private employer delayed its return to office plans because of the coronavirus. Wells Fargo will not require employees to be back at their offices until October. Previously, the company planned to bring some workers back to offices next month. Meanwhile, the Meredith Corporation and EMC Insurance also pushed back their return-to-work office plans. And last week, the Des Moines Public School District temporarily closed two Metro Kids daycare programs because of the coronavirus. The district announced that the programs at Hubble Elementary and Greenwood Elementary would be closed at least until today. The district also announced that parents with elementary school children in Des Moines would have an online learning option this fall. And the Ankeny School Board announced that that district would offer a remote learning option this fall for some students who meet certain qualifications. Meanwhile, Des Moines School District Superintendent Tom Ahart will start the new academic year with a letter of reprimand from the state's Educational Licensing Agency. That's a symbolic slap on the wrist after district officials defied the state last fall, keeping students online and out of classrooms during the coronavirus pandemic. And in another coronavirus and education-related story, the State Department of Education released results that showed reading scores are now bouncing back from learning lost last year because of the coronavirus, but that math scores have declined across the board. Meanwhile, Word that nearly all of Iowa's 99 counties fall under a new eviction moratorium the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention put into place last week. The new order bans certain evictions where either substantial or high levels of community coronavirus transmission are taking place. And there was word that 8 months after Congress first approved emergency pandemic assistance for people in danger of losing their homes, the Iowa Finance Authority cleared a backlog of applications from Iowa renters and landlords seeking the money. It has provided more than $9 million in rental and utility aid to nearly 3,500 households in Iowa. Now, the Molly Tibbetts story. A judge rejected a motion last week to retry Christian Bahena Rivera in the death of University of Iowa student Molly Tibbetts. That clears the path for Bahena Rivera to be sentenced in the Brooklyn, Iowa woman's 2018 murder. Bahena Rivera was convicted of first-degree murder after a 2-week trial earlier this year. In June, his lawyers had asked that he be granted a new trial, saying that new evidence pointed to new possible suspects. They said that Tibbetts' death might have been connected to alleged sex trafficking. The judge's ruling clears the way for Bahena Rivera to be sentenced August 30th. He faces life in prison without the possibility of parole. Also last week, one of the inmates charged with murder in the killings of two employees at the Anamosa State Penitentiary pleaded guilty. 38-year-old Thomas Woodard Jr. faces a mandatory sentence of life in prison without parole. Fellow inmate Michael Dutcher, who is 29 years old, is still set to be tried on the charges. Now for an update on that accident at Adventureland in Altoona over the 4th of July weekend that resulted in the death of an 11-year-old boy and injuries to his 16-year-old brother. That 16-year-old, David Jaramillo, spent 4 weeks at Blank Children's Hospital in Des Moines. And last Tuesday, he went home to Marion. He had regained his vision, his speech, his ability to walk, and his ability to eat solid food. His father called it a miracle. Meanwhile, a lawyer for the boy's family criticized Adventureland officials for what he said was their refusal to cooperate with an investigation of the accident. The park's lawyer said the family's lawyer is refusing to allow park officials to interview them. Also last week, word that the Iowa Department of Public Safety will no longer ban protesters who had been arrested at the state capitol from entering the building, and will pay them $70,000. 5 protesters had sued Department of Public Safety Commissioner Stephen Bayens, arguing the blanket ban they received from law enforcement officials was illegal. The group was among 17 protesters Des Moines police arrested on charges of disorderly conduct or assault at the Capitol in July of 2020. In the world of politics last week, word that Iowa Democratic Congresswoman Cindy Axne endorsed her former colleague Abby Finkenauer's U.S. Senate campaign. That is an indication that Axne will not seek the Senate seat herself, as she instead weighs a possible re-election bid or gubernatorial run. Finkenauer was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 2018, but lost her re-election bid last year. She said she will run for the U.S. Senate seat now held by Republican Chuck Grassley. He is 87 years old and has not yet announced whether he'll seek an 8th term. Axne has represented Iowa's 3rd congressional district since 2018. There was also word that a special election would be held September 14th to fill the Iowa House seat that became vacant after the death of State Representative John Landon. The 71-year-old Landon was a Republican serving his 5th term in the House. He represented District 37, which includes Ankeny, Alleman, and part of rural Polk County. Also last week, word that the State Court of Appeals had ruled that the owners of Manchester's Cricket Hollow Zoo were not denied a fair trial by a judge who had closed the attraction after citing what the judge called deplorable conditions that she'd seen there. The park's 2 owners had appealed a 2019 court ruling declaring the zoo to be a public nuisance. And word last week that Nationwide Mutual Insurance, one of the 10 biggest employers in the city of Des Moines, had donated $3 million to the effort to transform Central Iowa's waterways into a recreational amenity for kayaking, fishing, and surfing. It's part of an effort to create a 150-mile network of water trails with boat launches and other recreational amenities like fishing passages and whitewater runs for paddlers in rivers across central Iowa. And there was word that Betty Lou Varnum, who had hosted the long-running children's show The House with the Magic Window on WOI-TV, had died at the age of 90. She had hosted that show for 40 years, making it the longest-running locally produced children's TV show in the nation. And one last note before I go. It's about the Major League Baseball game that will be held this coming Thursday night at the Field of Dreams in Dyersville, Iowa. Some Iowans who had signed up at the MLB website for the chance to buy tickets for the game found out they had been chosen. Those tickets did not come cheap, but people gobbled them up anyway. After all, it's a chance to see the first Major League Baseball game ever in Iowa, and it's a game between the legendary New York Yankees and the Chicago White Sox. The White Sox happen to be in first place in the American League Central Division. I wish I could be there. But those of us who are not lucky enough to get tickets, well, we'll just have to watch the game on Fox TV. It's being broadcast nationwide on the big network, not the cable one. So on this Thursday night, Iowa is going to be the center of the sports viewing universe here in the United States. And that's it for now, at least for me. I'm Dennis Hart. I'll be right back here on KHOI again tonight at 7 o'clock on Capital Week with Laura Bellin, when we'll talk about politics, Iowa style, and what's been happening that affects all of us. And then Paul Wearson and I will be here hosting Local Talk this coming Wednesday morning at 7, when our guest will be the new police chief of Ames and the new Ames School District Superintendent. I hope you can be here for all of that. In the meantime, go ahead and have a great week.
I got my vaccination. I'm out the house by Uncanny Alliance. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for the hour, Ursula Rudenberg. And thank you, Mr. Hart, for the news roundup. So we're going to completely switch gears now to commemorate the anniversaries of this time of the year of the U.S. atomic bombs over Japan. The first bomb was dropped on Hiroshima on August 6th in 1945. And the second bomb was dropped on Nagasaki on this date today, August 9th in 1945. No doubt this must always be a very difficult week in that country. The long shadow of these events is a global story, obviously, but it is also, as you may know, a local story to Ames and Iowa State, where the scientists were part of the Manhattan Project to build the bombs. And there's a lot to be said about what happened. But today we're going to stick with the stories of several people who were there on the ground in these two cities. Please be advised that the stories you will hear are painful and include graphic descriptions of war trauma and suffering, in case you wish to skip this and turn away. And I apologize for it, but there really is no easy way to talk about Nagasaki and Hiroshima. So first we'll hear a recording from the Pacific Radio Archives, the oldest collection of audio archives in the U.S. In 1980, Shugeko Sasamori gave a talk at UCLA at the Physicians for Social Responsibility. Sasamori was a teenager living in Hiroshima at the time of the attack, and she was disfigured and became what were called the elephant people, who could not be seen in public. In 1955, American journalist Norman Cousins brought 25 young women, who were crippled and disfigured, victims of the bombing, to the United States in what was called the Hiroshima Project, where they received plastic surgery. Sasamori was one of those women. She immigrated to the United States, and she eventually became a citizen. So here is her presentation to Physicians for Social Responsibility.
Mr. Norman Cousins brought 25 crippled and severely disfigured young women who had not been able to be seen in society and for whom medical treatment was not available to the U.S. in 1955 for plastic surgery. Among those was Shigeko Sasamori, now a U.S. citizen, who works as a nurse and an ambassador.
Good evening, everybody. I have been talking about my experience to so many people, so many places, but every time I tell story about myself, my experience, I remember things just like happened yesterday, and so I can be easy to remember the so horrible Holocaust. I was 13 years old. The morning was a beautiful sky, and I was a student, and I saw the airplane dropping atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Almost same time when I saw the bomb falling off, I felt a very strong explosion and knocked me down. I don't know how long it passed by, but when I look around, everybody different and just different world, just like a hell. The people wasn't like a people, like more hurt and completely different. And especially, I noticed nobody screaming like a dead person. I'm sure everybody was shocked. I couldn't talk either. All the people who came from hell and walking slowly, and at the time wasn't burning Hiroshima City, just dust and people moving. That's all I saw. Then later on, the fire started, and I was fortunately, I didn't go into the center. I went to the out of the center. That's why I survived. And also, many people come to the river because it's so hot and everybody going to the river and pushing each other and many people drowning. When I saw that, I was afraid pretty soon somebody pushing me into the water. So I pushed people away to go back to the street, then try to the out of the city. And 4 days, I was in an auditorium, some schools. I don't know how I get there. I just follow the people. I stayed there 4 days, and my mother found me and took me home, which house was fortunately wasn't completely broke down, so a little bit under the roof left, so my mother able to take care of me. She used the soybean oil, because no doctor, no nurses can help me. Many people thought I'm going to die. And about months later, I can able to walk and go outside to saw the Hiroshima City. Then I saw another different view of the Hiroshima City, because at that time, city was all burned and just black. And still at the night, I can able to see smoke coming up. Right? I asked the people what that smoke, and they said the dead people still burning under the house. Anyway, still many people dying, so they have to burn. The months and after months, a couple months, continued like that. And then when I walking to see how people live, people just pick up the leftover the woods and build little shack. living in there, and the people burn and stay there, and those people's body have covered of the worms because fly stay and make the worms. And Hiroshima City, just a terrible, terrible city was a long time. Of course, as you see my hand, the burn, and one third of my body is burned, and my father cut off my hair and cut off my skin, the face, and after I even healed and able to walk in the street, I'm not look like a human being's face either. And red skin and very skinny and the pointy nose and the big eyes. And when I first time I saw myself, I couldn't believe that was me, like a monster I was seeing. Those experience, I will tell the people much I can to tell how war is a terrible thing for the human beings. I don't feel I'm not one only victim. I think you all people, everybody, some connection to the victims. Once the war starts, everybody's the victims. I survived it. 10 years later, Mr. Norman Cousin made the Hiroshima Project and brought the 25 girls in this country, had a plastic surgery operation. Plastic surgery operation is very successful, and I learned humans love. No matter who you are, see, American and Japanese used to be enemy, but when I came to the United States, I see those people's love and kindness. I learned that that's a big thing. If I stayed in Japan, probably I never understood this much. Now I feel I have a mission to talk to the people who ever want to know my experience, how the war was. Right now I'm working as a baby nurse and take care of a newborn baby. And every time I see this baby, so beautiful. We got to have a beautiful world for them, for no reason to them to die and go to war, or no reason to them to have a horrible world. So we have a big responsibility to help the better world for them. And I like the people to understand such an innocent, beautiful children come to this world. What kind of world waiting for them? But all I can say is, I just ask you people, I'm sure most people are parents. Everybody loves on children. So simple, just to everybody get together to help each other.
And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for the hour. Thank you for listening to what I know is a painful edition of this show. We're commemorating the anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, events that Ames and Iowa State are directly connected to, as you probably know, through their part in the Manhattan Project that developed the bombs. The recording you just heard was from the Pacifica Radio Archives in 1980. Shugeko Sasamori gave a talk at UCLA to the Physicians for Social Responsibility. Nagasaki was attacked 3 days later after Hiroshima on this date, August 9th, 1945. The National Radio Project assembled some of the stories of people who were there, a production called Lessons from Nagasaki. Here's an abbreviated version of what they produced.
We decided we wanted to see what was in Nagasaki. It was just dust and debris. And the smell was horrible. You could smell death all around you.
The U.S. dropped the world's first atomic bomb on Hiroshima, Japan on August 6, 1945. 3 days later, the fishing village of Nagasaki also fell victim.
I tried to be quiet, but there were bones lying all entangled. And when I took a step, they would crack.
We commemorate the anniversary of the bombings with excerpts from two documentaries, Hiroshima Countdown and Nagasaki Journey. I'm Kyungjin Lee, and this is Making Contact. Originally, Nagasaki was not the intended target for the second atomic bomb. But when clouds and smoke blocked the pilots' visibility of the primary target, they proceeded to the port town. The bomb killed or injured one-third of the total population. and the remaining survivors, as well as many American soldiers who occupied Japan, continue to struggle with the trauma. Andrew Phillips' documentary film, Hiroshima Countdown, includes first-hand accounts from the pilots who dropped the bomb in Nagasaki.
This is one in a series of interviews conducted by the Air Force Historical Division. Today we are interviewing Brigadier General Paul W. Tibbets, Jr., who is retired.
They offered such a, you could almost say a classroom experiment as far as being able to determine later the bomb damage. These were good virgin targets, and they were ideal for the purpose that we wanted to use them for.
The consideration of targets would be Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Niigata, Kakura, and there's one more that I don't remember. The 20th Air Force had been told they would not attack those targets under any circumstances. In other words, the ground was laid.
As well as these targets, Kyoto, Japan's ancient capital, was strongly recommended by the man with overall control of the bomb project, General Leslie Groves. But Secretary of War Henry Stimson, approaching 80 years of age, would not have it. He'd visited Kyoto with his wife in the 20s and had enjoyed the city's cultural riches. It was a city of great religious significance to the Japanese, and Stimson felt Kyoto's destruction would damage America's post-war stature.
The selection of the targets in the month of May 1945 was actually done by the intelligence community in headquarters U.S. Air Force. The requirements given to them was, you will select cities that have military targets in them. And they also selected the type of terrain that they wanted. They also were interested in the type of construction that they could expect to run into. Because in reality, not only was this a military mission, but it was also of extreme scientific importance because they wanted to know what a weapon of this type could do against reinforced concrete, what it could do against steel, what it would do against anything that was in the building materials line. It had to be something that had not been attacked by the 20th Air Force up to that time. Call it virgin targets, undamaged, unhurt by any other type of an explosive or munition.
I knew the type of bomb we were working on.
Charles Sweeney flew with Tibbets in an observer aircraft to witness the bombing of Hiroshima. 3 days later, he would lead his crew first to Kakura, the primary target for the second bomb, and then to Nagasaki. Kakura was clouded in that day.
As he was talking, he picked up a handful of earth. He said, basically what we're working on is a single bomb that will turn a whole city into this. And he just tossed a handful of sand into the air.
While the American pilots saw the devastation wrought by the bomb, they didn't experience the death and destruction felt by those on the ground. Up next, we bring you a radio adaptation of the film Nagasaki Journey, which shares the stories of two Japanese survivors and a U.S. Marine who occupied the city when the war ended. The film was produced by Christopher Beaver and Judy Irving.
On August 9th, 1945, 3 days after the destruction of Hiroshima, a B-29 bomber under the command of the United States Army Air Forces also destroyed the city of Nagasaki. On the ground beneath the atomic explosion, temperatures were hot enough to melt concrete and steel. Within seconds, more than 70,000 people had been killed and another 100,000 fatally injured. On the surface, Nagasaki today looks normal, yet hidden from the casual visitor in hospitals and homes, the atomic bomb continues to claim its final victims. Soon, the last survivors will be gone, their personal accounts relegated to history. One of the few visible traces remaining stands on an overlook above the city, a single broken torii gate marking the pathway to a hillside shrine. But even the few visible traces are more obvious than the effect of the bomb on the spirit. This is Sumiteru Taniguchi, home from his job at the post office. In 1945, when the bomb dropped, he was 16 years old.
私、自転車で道路を走っていてね、 I was riding my bicycle, delivering mail, when I heard what seemed to be the faint roar of an aircraft. And the instant that I thought that a plane might have come in, I was thrown or blown with my bicycle. I gathered up the scattered letters and put them with my bicycle. Then I walked to an air raid shelter about 350 yards away. I sat down on a ledge and realized I could no longer stand. I had many nightmares in which I felt the approach of death. I don't know whether to call it a dream or just a memory of a painful time. I was only a child, but I had been taught in school that Japan would definitely win the war and that winning was correct. And I believed that Japan would win. During the time I lay in bed, I began to hate my parents. Everyone's parent. I found myself hating not only the war itself, but all the parents who had not opposed it.
The Japanese surrender was announced on August 14, 1945, less than 1 week after the destruction of Nagasaki. For most Americans, the bomb meant peace and victory, and an end to the Second World War. It meant the troops were coming home. But many American troops did not go home, no matter how homesick and war-weary they were. For many of them, it was time to go to Japan, not as the invasion force they had expected to be, but as a military occupation to disarm the Japanese and ensure the peace. And for the Japanese, who had been at war since their invasion of China in 1937, it was time to accept the inconceivable. It was time to meet the powerful enemy who had defeated them. Among the U.S. Marines destined for Japan was a 29-year-old postal clerk named Victor Talley, whose chance encounter in Nagasaki would change his life.
We were not going in as warriors. We were not going to fight these people or invade them or get killed or injured. We knew this time we were the winners. Now, the first thing my troop ship saw was the Mitsubishi shipyard. And when those men saw that, they were very subdued. And then in a murmur, you could hear them say, "God, look what it did. One bomb did that. Jesus, I'm glad it was them and not us."
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. We now return to a radio adaptation of the documentary film Nagasaki Journey by Christopher Beaver and Judy Irving.
Left behind was a city still searching for its missing children. A city where a woman named Itsuko Okubo was about to discover the fate of her long-lost son, a young medical student named Akira.
He loved planes and warships and often drew them as well. He was a child who was born in war and died in war, and that must have been his fate.
When the bomb dropped and Akira did not come home, Mrs. Okubo started searching for him.
It was 1945, August 9th, 1945, when the bomb dropped. And Akira did not come home the next day, so I started looking for him. But could learn nothing. Then I heard he had been in class at the medical college lecture hall at the time of the blast, and I went to see the ruins there. When I arrived, I was completely beside myself. I tried to be quiet. I kicked off my sandals and entered the place in only my tabi socks. But there were bones lying all entangled, and when I took a step, they would crack. Finally, I took 4 or 5 gold buttons from the uniform of his school and part of a school cap and some bones home with me. We paid our last respects and had a very simple funeral. Even after this, I felt somehow that he was alive somewhere. And at night, if I heard the sound of footsteps, I would think he had returned. And I often jumped up to check. But he did not return. And I gave up hope. The new year dawned with everything in disorder. But on January 18, 1946, Akira's remains were discovered halfway up Mount Kompira beside a power station, lying buried face down in dead leaves. Positive identification was provided by a name tag that had been sewn on the back of his leggings. From the time he was in junior high school, Akira always wandered around this area because he loved to collect insects. He had an uncle on the other side of the mountain, and I think that he tried to flee there, taking the shortest route possible and using a path few people traveled. I shall never forget the kindness of the electrical lineman who discovered Akira's body.
Mrs. Okubo died shortly before the 50th anniversary of the atomic bombing.
He was a child who was born in war and died in war, and that must have been his fate.
Mrs. Okubo, survived by 4 sons and 3 daughters, is remembered in the home she occupied when she began her search for Akira. Each year in Nagasaki, as the city continues to expand, fewer and fewer residents have firsthand memories of the atomic bomb. Yet its invisible effect lingers. The bombs that exploded here and in Hiroshima triggered the atomic age, which now casts its shadow around the world.
It changed my whole philosophy of life. I think I wanted to be kinder to people. I didn't want to get mad at people. I didn't ever want to have to kill anybody again.
Victor Talley devoted his retirement to the cause of American veterans who had been exposed to radiation, not only in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but in hundreds of peacetime atomic tests.
I found myself hating not only the war itself, but all the parents who had not opposed it.
After Sumiteru Taniguchi retired, he became a full-time volunteer at the Atomic Bomb Survivors Council, teaching a different lesson than he had been taught as a child. When the final story is told, when the last survivor is gone, this legacy will pass to another generation. Perhaps they will determine whether Nagasaki was simply the second city to be bombed, or whether it will be the last.
For more information about the documentaries we excerpted today, Nagasaki Journey and Hiroshima Countdown, go to our website, radioproject.org. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or check out our website, radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Andrew Stelzer and George Lavender producers, Juanita Carol Young, development manager, Irene Flores, web editor, Lisa Bartfai, Salima Hamarani, and Aaron Mathewson, production interns, and Barbara Barnett, Dan Turner, and Alton Bird, volunteers. I'm Kyungjin Lee.
And that was a shortened version of a production by the National Radio Project called Lessons from Nagasaki. The National Radio Project produces Making Contact, which is a show that airs on KHOI every Thursday at 1:30 p.m., providing kind of little mini-documentaries about events around the world. And this is Local Talk. I'm Ursula Rudenberg here, your host for the hour. Thank you for being with us this morning. Been a somber day to remember the events that happened over in Japan. So, speaking of events to be concerned about, we're going to talk about the drought. And we have here Melissa Spencer, who is the deputy coordinator, Story County Emergency Management, here for their monthly check-in. Melissa, you were prepared to speak to us a little bit about the drought that's going on and also to discuss some energy conservation practices that we can think about during this time. Welcome back to Local Talk.
Thank you for having me. I greatly appreciate you allowing us some time again this month to talk this time about the drought and how we can help with some electrical conservation during these rather warm temperatures that we seem to be consistently having.
That's right. It's what we're doing right now.
Yeah. Today is going to be another one of those extremely warm days for sure that is not going to really help our drought situation. Right now, when I first put my notes together, we were still in that moderate to severe category over Story County, but I just checked this morning and pretty much all of Story County is under a severe drought. So, you know, unfortunately, the little bit of rain we got in the overnight last night and some of the rain that we got this weekend probably won't break our drought for sure. You know, looking back over the last year, we're about 11 inches behind on our precipitation.
Wow, that's October. Quite a bit, right?
Yeah, that is quite a bit. And that's something that it can be hard to make up. You know, we're having these smaller rain events, which is beneficial But when you really think about 11 inches of rain, that's quite a bit to try to break that drought. So, you know, unfortunately, the news for the rest of the summer and into the fall is not great. You know, the Weather Service is forecasting above normal temperatures. So we're going to still continue to have some of those warmer days going in through October. And then below normal precipitation. So that does not help our drought situation any. So it is something that people need to start thinking about how they can prepare themselves and ensure that their community, do their little bit of part to ensure that their community can continue to have a good solid water supply.
And no doubt your office is also planning and responding to the situation, right?
Yeah, we have been working with multiple communities throughout the county to help them evaluate their water delivery systems and make sure that to monitor for if their systems are becoming overloaded. We're trying to gather for our office and for our planning purposes an understanding of their capacity. How does their operation work? And really thinking about how can we make sure that that public safety piece is met, that a community still has safe drinking water, has water for wastewater operations. That might not be something that people think about a lot, but it does take some water to make sure that that wastewater is getting handled correctly. And then also just making sure that the community has firefighting water. You know, if there would be a fire in the community that could happen during this drought time, we want to make sure that that water supply is there. So we're also working with Iowa Homeland Security and the National Weather Service to continue to monitor these. And also the Iowa Department of Natural Resources is another partner that has been sharing information with emergency managers on the water supplies, the capacities, the wells, where the wells are, how big are the wells, and also letting us know about areas or communities that they are concerned about as well. So it's really a group effort.
Yeah, you know, you've listed these three areas that are kind of public uses of water, the drinking, the firefighting, and the waste operations. But there's also, I'm sure a lot of people are also watering their yards and their gardens, right? So there's probably quite a bit of water being used for that purpose as well.
Yeah, there is. You know, right now, there are not any mandatory conservation practices that have been put in place that we are made aware of by the communities. But there really is some simple steps that people can take in their own homes. You know, a lot of folks have watering systems that come on and put a little bit of water on every day. Really, looking at some of the information that is out there, really, you only need to water your lawn about one day a week for about a half an hour. They say if you step on your grass and it bounces back, even if it's a little bit brown, that's okay. Your grass will come back. But really, you know, a lot of folks, your yard will go dormant, but it will come back. It may not look good for a while, but it will come back. So just reducing that lawn watering to one day a week is hugely beneficial. You water it for a little bit longer, but you're only doing it for that one day a week rather than a little bit at a time every day.
Yeah, well, I've been watching my tomatoes, wondering if they're going to be able to produce something or not. I've kind of been holding back on watering them a whole lot, but I kind of wonder, you know, wonder how they're going to do.
Yeah, and yeah, unfortunately, I'm not a person that can grow things, so I can't help you too much there. But, you know, some communities are asking for people to reduce their watering, be cognizant of, you know, maybe don't wash the car in the driveway on the weekend. You know, actually taking it to a car wash does actually reduce the amount of water that you would use versus standing in your driveway. So asking folks to do that, making sure when you're doing laundry, I didn't think about this one until I really read it, making sure you're doing good full loads of laundry. And doing it in the morning or evening, and that kind of goes along
Why
is with that. That energy.
Why?
Well, that goes along with that energy conservation piece. Is usually during the daytime hours. There's businesses are open normal day to day business is being taken care of. You have a higher demand on the electrical grid, So if you could do those in the morning and the evening, when that electrical demand is lower, beyond just making sure you got a full load, you may be helping with some energy conservation as well, with putting demand on the electrical grid in your area.
Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah, that was something that was new to me as well.
Okay, so laundry in the morning or evening, but not during the day. Okay.
Yep, that's what they recommend out there. Showers instead of baths, because again, you know, it's just that volume of water. And then look for any leaks that you may have in your faucets, any exterior hoses that you may have outside. Check for leaks, just because it's amazing how much water can leak in just a short period of time, is another thing to look for.
So showers generally use less water than baths?
Yep.
Okay.
I know it was a little bit shocking to me, too. I was like, oh, okay.
Okay.
That was some of the guidance that FEMA has put out for some water conservation practices.
Okay.
But just anything you can do to kind of reduce that load. They do talk about, you know, maybe not flushing the toilet as often, if you can avoid that. They also talk about taking a gallon milk jug and putting water in it and then putting it inside your toilet tank, because then it helps displace. Then you aren't flushing as much water at a time when you do flush the toilet, which is another
method. Oh, I see, because it just adds volume to the liquid in there. Okay.
Yep. So that's those are kind of some tips that we can do at home to really kind of help with those water conservation practices.
Do you think that this really makes a difference?
I really do. I really do think these, if everybody is taking the time to maybe reduce that lawn watering, not washing the car in the driveway, you know, looking for any leaks or anything like that, I really think that if everybody starts to do some of these practices, it can make a difference. But it does take everybody. Everybody needs to kind of try to pitch in and do as much of their part as they can to try to ensure that those water systems stay up and running. I mean, right now, you know, a lot of the things that are coming out from the communities are voluntary.
Okay. You got this from the Story County Emergency. Number one, reduce watering your lawn to one day a week. Number two, do your laundry in the morning and the evening and just wait till there's a full load, right? Don't do little loads. And number three, take a shower instead of a bath. A shower is an adult bath anyway, so that's good. And then check your house for leaky faucets or leaky hoses, and this can make a difference. So listen up. Okay.
Yeah.
And thank you for contributing to helping us get through the drought. So now we're going to talk about energy, right?
Yeah, and kind of some of this goes a little bit hand in hand. We're not hearing from any of our energy sector partners that there is any concern to have at this time. But as we really go into these hot days, and especially these really humid days, you know, a lot of us want to turn the air conditioner up to help compensate with that. But we really do kind of like with water conservation, we really want to look at how can we reduce our demand during peak usage. And again, that daytime window when everybody's out moving around and business is being conducted really does put a demand on the electrical grid. So really simple things that we can do. Just closing your drapes. It's amazing that how much that can change the temperature in your home. Similar to doing the laundry in the morning or evening, do any other cleaning in your house in the morning or evening when it's cooler.
Because
as you're moving around the house cleaning and taking care of things, you may be getting warm and you may have that urge to bump that thermostat to try to cool down a little bit. And you know, if you do it in the morning or evening, you might not have that urge to bump that thermostat and put that load. Turning up your thermostat 3 to 5 degrees from where you maybe normally would have it, or when you're not home during the day, if you have a programmable thermostat, you know, setting it to be a little bit warmer when nobody's going to be home during the day. Or if you can, just bump that up a few degrees if you are home during the day. Of course, avoid using the oven if we can in the afternoon or early evening. Again, that just heats up the house and your air conditioner is going to run probably a little bit harder. So trying to find ways to maybe not run that so often, maybe grill outside instead of turning on your oven in the house in the afternoon or early evening. And again, just turning off lights when not needed. You know, I know sometimes I follow my kids from room to room to room, and I'm shutting off lights behind them as we go.
Yeah, I did that in the radio station.
that does make a huge difference as well.
So peak energy times are when again?
You're usually really seeing those peak energy times during what we would call business hours, mm-hmm. where people are out conducting business, businesses are open and putting a demand on the grid, a higher demand on the grid during the day than in, you know, after that 5 o'clock time frame. So it's kind of during those normal work hours that they really start to see some of those peak demands going up. You know, some in the evening is if people get home and they're really pushing, really turning down those thermostats, sometimes even there could be a load. But what they're looking at is during that prime working hour where you can have a high load on the system.
Okay. Well, we've got some good energy reduction tips then to reduce demand during the peak hours, close drapes to keep the house cooler, do cleaning in the morning and the evening when it's cooler so you don't get heated up. Turn the thermostat up 3 to 5 degrees, avoid using the oven in the afternoon, the early evening, and turn off the lights. Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate that. Final words?
We just thank you for allowing us the time to be able to come out and talk to folks about this. And again, it does take everybody to help try to do these things. So we just encourage folks to follow these simple tips and help everybody get through the drought and any high electrical demand we have with this warm weather coming up.
Okay, and thank you, Melissa Spencer, Deputy Coordinator of Story County Emergency Management, and we always appreciate your coming and talking to us, whether it's drought, floods, tornadoes, you name it. It's happening. Thank you so much for being with us. And you've been listening to Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Ursula Rudenberg. Remember, you can hear Local Talk online at khoifm.org. And later during the day, and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI does stream live at khoifm.org. The program is engineered by Mike Murphy. Thank you, Mike. Thanks also to the National Radio Project and the Pacifica Radio Archives for the productions they provided for this show. Stay tuned for Headline News and Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. and Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m. Theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you would like to try your hand at reporting, you are welcome to join us. We'll train you and help you get started on that. Thank you, most of all, to you, the listener, who are on the other end of this radio. Thank you. You are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we will see you again on the radio.